Those of you who are aware of the volleyball courts down the road a ways here and who have watched or participated in it are probably aware of what's known as a setup, in which one teammate helps another to get the ball over the net in as violent a manner as possible. But I suspect that what Willie's been doing in here this morning is in a sense a setup for what I would like to do. And I suppose I come on sort of like philosophers always have, not to do anything so much as to already talk about what's been done. He alluded a couple of times earlier this morning to something I had done last week entitled The Death of the Soul, in which I talked about soul as a specific concept coming out of Platonistic philosophy and infusing our entire culture, and the fact that in the 20th century this concept has been very seriously challenged in a variety of areas, in biology, in computer technology, all sorts of areas where the question about whether or not man is really a dualistic entity composed of both a body and a soul can be maintained in the face of the evidence. Now, what was challenged there, of course, is the lack of a specific kind of entity to which you can point or which is somehow a part of our experience. Now, as he also said, this is not to deny anything like spirit or soul in the sense that that word might occur in soul brother or something. Because again, if you go back to the volleyball courts, you can tell just by watching behavior which players are spirited and which are not. You don't have to somehow have a mystical access to an occult entity and processes that are going on in that occult entity to know whether or not the man is spirited. All you have to do is watch his behavior in a given context, whether it's a volleyball court or a riot or whatever it is. You don't have to somehow have this mystical communion. So I just wanted to use that in a way also as a setup for what I wish to do this morning. Now, the title for this morning's talk comes from a poem by T.S. Eliot entitled Hollow Men. And I'd like to begin just by reading a few lines from the poem to sort of set the tone and then go on this morning. We are the hollow men. We are the stuffed men leaning together, headpiece filled with straw. Alas, our dried voices when we whisper together are quiet and meaningless as wind in dry grass, or rat's feet over broken glass in our dry cellar. Shape without form, shade without color, paralyzed force, gesture without motion. Those who have crossed with direct eyes to death's other kingdom remember us, if at all, not as lost, violent souls, but only as the hollow men, the stuffed men. This is the dead land. This is cactus land. Here the stone images are raised. Here they receive the supplication of a dead man's hand under the twinkle of a fading star. Is it like this in death's other kingdom, waking alone at the hour when we are trembling with tenderness? Lips that would kiss form prayers to broken stone. The eyes are not here. There are no eyes here in this valley of dying stars, in this hollow valley, this broken jaw of our lost kingdoms. In this last of meeting places, we grope together and avoid speech, gathered on this beach of the tumid river. Sightless, unless the eyes reappear as the perpetual star, multifoliate rose of death's twilight kingdom, the hope only of empty men. Here we go round the prickly pear, prickly pear, prickly pear. Here we go round the prickly pear at 5 o'clock in the morning. Between the idea and the reality, between the motion and the act falls the shadow, for thine is the kingdom. Between the conception and the creation, between the emotion and the response falls the shadow. Life is very long. Between the desire and the spasm, between the potency and the existence, between the essence and the descent, falls the shadow. For thine is the kingdom. For thine is, life is, for thine is the, this is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper. Now, I almost entitled this morning's lecture, Know Thyself, borrowing from that famous aphorism of Socrates. And in a sense, I suspect this is the very sort of thing that Will has been pushing us to, namely, a greater awareness of ourselves, or as he's put it over and over again, telling it like it is. And it seems to me that this is one of the most severe challenges that we can possibly have, to try and become aware of ourselves. Because in our age, an age of conglomerates and corporations and church mergers and whatnot, we seem to have lost the sense of the significance and the worth of the self. And it seems that each person must work out self-consciousness for himself. It can't be handed from the outside. I mean, even Will can't tell you who you are in the final analysis. You have to perhaps take some hints from him and then go looking around and hunting and trying to find out for yourself. Back as far as 1952, there was an article in Life magazine, January 7th, if you want to check it out, entitled The Wife Problem, which talked about the problems that corporation executives' wives have in living their own lives or in not living their own lives. That it wasn't only the preacher's wife anymore who was checked out by the board of trustees, but that now it was the executive's wife who was checked out by the other managers of the corporation. And her friends, her daily activity, the type of car she drove, the style of clothes she wore, everything was governed by the corporation. That it was okay to keep up with the Joneses, but not to get ahead of them. And so on. I mean, this article was very extensive, but this seems to be a serious problem that we have. I mean, this has been reflected in a whole series of studies like Riesman's The Lonely Crowd and so on. That loneliness and anxiety seem part of our culture, and that this is really the problem of hollowness. Not that we've lost this mystical entity called a soul and that people can't really relate to it anymore, but rather that we are no longer sensitive to what we feel or to what we really want. We're really perhaps not even sensitive to the context in which we operate or how we behave in that context. Now, it seems to me that self-awareness, if you want to put it that way, is hard and dangerous work. I mean, it is dangerous has been illustrated by the life of Socrates, because the people whom he pushed to self-awareness, not necessarily in any racial sense, but just in terms of what it was to be a human being, eventually had him put to death. And it's also very hard work. I mean, Socrates himself devoted his entire life to it. And we have certain stories, if you wish, or myths or whatever, which come down to us in our culture, which state the same point. And I'd like really, in effect, just to sort of be a storyteller this morning. I started the lecture last week by reading from Through the Looking Glass with Alice in Wonderland. And it seems to me that some of these stories perhaps convey quite a bit to us. And the stories I'd like to look at this morning come out of both the Hebrew and the Greek traditions. The Hebrew one will be Adam and Eve, and the Greek one, well, there's a whole series of them. One is the myth of Prometheus, and then we have the dramas like of Oedipus and Orestes and so on, about these figures, that is, which also tell us certain things about self-awareness and what the results of it might or might not be and how hard it is to really come up with this. But first of all, I'd like to start with Adam and Eve, not, I should emphasize, a theological interpretation by any means. Those of you who worry about what happens to God in this interpretation can perhaps discuss that later in the discussion session. But how do we put it? Let's start out here with the fact that Adam and Eve, as the story begins, as the Bible puts it, do not know that they are naked. Or if you want to put it psychologically, and I'm not a professional psychologist here, I'm just sort of crossing boundaries as we tend to do up here at Holden. Adam and Eve really have no anxiety or guilt. They have no conflict with the earth. The earth provides them everything they need, no struggle, no sweat there. They have no psychological conflict within themselves. They're not torn by anxiety or guilt, as I said. Nor do they have any conflict with God. Everything is total harmony. Now, at this point, we get this forbidden fruit, or this forbidden tree. And it's always been very curious to me why this particular tree. Why a tree about the knowledge of good and evil? What happened, of course, in the story was that they ate of this tree. And the first evidence of their knowledge of good and evil was their experience of anxiety and guilt. They became aware of their nakedness, and they hid from God, because they suddenly now had this ethical awareness. And it seems to me at least one of the morals of this story, coming out of a rather ancient civilization, ancient to us at least, anywhere from 800 to 1,000 years before Christ, is that self-awareness and ethical awareness somehow go together. If you become more aware of who you are, of what it is to be a human being, you somehow also get this increased knowledge of good and evil, of ethical concepts. A second thing that happened, of course, was that they became aware of their finiteness, of the fact that they eventually had to die. Dust you are, and to dust you return, the Lord eventually tells them. Now, in this story, what exactly is going on? In one sense, I suppose, if we looked at it from the perspective of child psychology, we could say that what the Mesopotamians there were describing is what happens to most persons between the ages of 1 and 3. namely the emergence of self-awareness. The Garden of Eden, for example, could symbolize the womb and early infancy. Ethical conflict, ethical responsibility just don't exist. No demands are put on. It's a period of real innocence, or as again the Bible puts it, knowing neither shame nor guilt. But then eventually with the beginnings of ethical sensitivity come self-consciousness. In the child himself comes a certain anxiety, sort of looking over his shoulder or looking around when he's about to do something, and eventually feelings of guilt. And finally also becomes aware of the fact that he is of the dust, that is, that he will someday die. Now the positive side of this seems to be that at this point we get, both in the, if you wish, the story and in the life of a child, we get the birth of both the psychological or the spiritual person. There's a sense in which, as we live day in and day out, it's at this point in the story that man, the human being, is born, or created, if you wish. Not on the so-called day of creation when God said, let us create man in our image. It's at this point that man, as we know him, is really born. And some philosophers, most notably Hegel in the 19th century, said that if this was to be described as a fall, it should probably be described as a fall upward, like falling up the stairs or something. Now, a second curious thing, at least to me, beside the fact that this story talks about the tree of the knowledge of good and evil being forbidden, is that it pictures this event happening against God's will and commandment. God is very angry and punishes them. Now, a serious question you might ask is, did God not wish to have us get knowledge of good and evil, or any sort of ethical sensitivity? Did he just want to keep his creatures in some sort of total state of innocence? It could be that the primitive storytellers, if we want to call them primitive, couldn't distinguish between some sort of constructive self-consciousness and rebellion. Or it could be that they were dealing in the context of a tribal deity, namely Yahweh, who was very jealous, as you read in portions of the Old Testament, a very jealous and in some ways vindictive deity. Now, to get at this question, I'd like to shift our focus to another story, namely the story of Prometheus in the Greek tradition and his relation to Zeus, the god there. And Prometheus, as I'm sure you are aware, was responsible for bringing the gift of fire to men. At one point only the gods had it, and then Prometheus delivered it to mankind with all of the benefits and perhaps the dangers, like we see in the signs around the village this morning, but all of the benefits, at least, thereto appertaining. Now what happened was Zeus got very mad when he saw this glow down on the earth, and so he chained Prometheus to a mountain and set up the following torture, that every day throughout the day, a vulture would eat away at Prometheus's liver, and then during the night, the liver would grow back again, and the next day, the vulture would return ad infinitum. So there was this great torture. And not only that, Zeus, in a sense, had an edge on Yahweh in cruelty. As a result of this event, he also sent the so-called Pandora's box, or as we at Holden would now call it, the demonic, among men. And this is what the Greeks, again, were saying, that certain demonic elements were let loose. And here, interestingly enough, by the gods themselves, I mean, this angry Zeus sent the box, and poor Pandora opened it up, and all this stuff escaped. But what seems to be said here, just as with the Adam and Eve story, is that certain, if you want to use this word, authorities or whatnot, are very angry when things like self-awareness, or in the Prometheus case, one interpretation is things like creativity, start to occur. We could look, I suppose, at Adam and Eve as a sort of story of increasing self-awareness, and Prometheus as the story of creativity. There's a sense, well, not a sense, the word Prometheus means forethought, which itself could be considered one aspect of self-awareness. If you wish, the torture in that story, I suppose, could be looked at as the type of inner conflict which comes with creativity. I mean, if you examine the lives of people whom we would consider creative in our culture, Michelangelo or Dostoevsky or people of this sort, their own testimony is that this creativity brings with it not just unmitigated joy but a fantastic conflict and trauma as this creation is occurring. But again, it seems to be the question is, what does it mean that God or the gods, if you wish, fight against man's creativity? This is at least a similar element in both stories, both in the Hebrew tradition and in the Greek tradition. One thing I suppose we could say, if we wanted to get somewhat theological, is that the myths seem to warn against a sort of false pride. that these people were in danger of attributing their own successes and their own abilities to themselves. And so they had to be humbled. They had to be put down somehow. God kicked Adam and Eve out of the garden and gave them this rather brutish relationship to the earth and conflict within themselves and pain in bearing children and all this stuff that the story relates. And Zeus sent Pandora's box so that the people down there would also have their type of suffering. Socrates himself, to whom I've already alluded, states that the only way you can really achieve any sort of understanding or wisdom, and I take it that still is valid some 2,500 years later, is to begin by admitting your own ignorance. This, at least it seems to me, is the biggest hurdle. And Socrates seems to have found the same thing. But perhaps a more relevant aspect of this for this morning, what's been going on here this morning, is that these stories, both Adam and Eve and Prometheus, show that self-awareness also represents a potential conflict with those who are in power, whether gods or parents. And in the creative person himself, or in the person who is getting this increasing self-awareness, there is a sort of fear of moving ahead. I mean, this isn't a completely a gain. There's also some difficulty involved. And I suppose we could look upon this either in individual terms, as I'm doing it, or in social terms. And if you want to replace Prometheus and Adam and Eve, say, with the phrase black people or black power or something of that sort. Now, the myths show not only a courageous side, particularly in the Prometheus case, but also a servile side as we go on to look at them. Namely, that people tend to prefer comfort to freedom and security to their own growth. Why else, you might ask, at least as we look at the way in which the Hebrews set up their story, why else did they make work a punishment? And in terms of the forum that was conducted Monday night, in terms of all that's been written in the last century about so-called work ethic, that work is your duty and so on, it's interesting to note that way back in this period, work was a punishment. The initial state was a beautiful, if you wish, workless leisure state. And then when these people followed it up, one of the things that God fastened upon them was work, labor in all of its various terms. So, I mean, it shows here, if you wish, a sort of perpetual longing to be taken care of. And also they show a sort of authoritarian side in various religious traditions, both in the Hebrew and the Greek traditions, which war or fight against new insights, new approaches, new ethical sensitivities, and so on. And it's in this sense that these ancient stories seem quite relevant in our day. Also the other ones I mentioned, which I won't elaborate on very much, namely Orestes and Oedipus. But, I mean, where, for instance, in one case, the revelation to Oedipus of the fact that he had killed his own father caused him to blind himself. Now, there's all sorts of interpretation that can be brought out there. But, I mean, here again, the fact that this self-awareness, which he really longed for, which he pressed his mother to give him, eventually led to this horrible act in relation to his own vision. I mean, it was almost too much to take. Now, our problem today is often expressed in this word or euphemism, conformity. We have very much around us both a psychology and a morality of adjustment. And there's a sense in which ethics becomes identified with obedience, as, for instance, in phrases like law and order, or the problem which we call the generation gap, which, of course, is more than just a problem of obedience, but also partly that. Obviously, if Adam had not disobeyed, he would never have been forced out of paradise. I mean, he could have gone along living this idyllic existence if he hadn't disobeyed. So in these stories, there's a sense in which, at least looking at it from my point of view, a premium is implicitly placed on not developing consciousness of one's self. It's almost as though the more unquestioning obedience, the better, and the less personal responsibility, the better, or else you're in trouble. You get work, you get labor pains, and so on. Now, we might ask, of course, in this context, in looking at these stories and our own situation, what, if anything, is ethical about obedience? I mean, obedience, pure and simple, outside of any context whatsoever. This seems to be a nebulous and a very questionable value. I mean, a well-trained dog seems to fulfill this standard better than any human being, just pure and simple obedience. And yet we don't go around praising the dog for any type of moral insight. Or again, the question about obedience, or if you wish, conformity to what? I mean, an interesting analogy might be that a person who really lives by this type of ethic would, in the year 1900, have been very repressed sexually. In 1925, he would have been mildly rebellious according to the accepted norms at that time. And in 1945, he would have guided his actions by the average of what was being done as presented in the Kinsey Report. That is, if this is really how one looks at an ethic of obedience, literally. So these little stories, Adam and Eve and Prometheus, have something important, it seems to me, to say about some of the very problems with which we are enmeshed today. We put it under labels of race issue or generation gap or perhaps even war and so on. But one of the major problems here being the growth of freedom of ethical sensitivity as over against certain established authorities represented in both the myths by the gods. Now, a question that is probably more relevant to Holden and the context in which we're operating here then is the church itself partly responsible for repressing life and for repressing people in our day? And I suppose this is partly the whole question that gets raised by the question of black church. Now again, dipping back into literature, and I ought to perhaps add a footnote at this point, that again, this is not strictly my field, although philosophy gets itself expressed in literature. We have a writer like Dostoevsky and his section in Brothers Karamazov about the Grand Inquisitor, from which I'd just like to read a very brief passage. But in this little parable or poem or whatever about the Grand Inquisitor, you find a representative, or in almost the way in which it's set up, the representative of the church questioning Christ, who had reappeared on earth, and discussing with him the role of the church in human events and the role of the church in relation to the figure of Christ himself. And the Grand Inquisitor says that, of course, Christ came to bring freedom, but Christ was, of course, very unrealistic. Because if Christ had only had his head screwed on, he would have realized that people didn't want freedom. What people wanted was the very thing that the devil offered him out in the wilderness, namely things like miracle, mystery, and authority. You know, in other words, they wanted bread, or as the Romans put it, bread and circuses. They didn't want this type of freedom. And, well, let me just read the passage and then perhaps be clearer than anything I would say. "Behold what thou didst further, and all again in the name of freedom. I tell thee that man is tormented by no greater anxiety than to find someone quickly to whom he can hand over that gift of freedom with which the ill-fated creature is born. But only one who can appease their conscience can take over their freedom. In bread there was offered thee an invincible banner. Give bread and man will worship thee, for nothing else is more certain than bread. But if someone else gains possession of his conscience, oh, then he will cast away thy bread and follow after him who has ensnared his conscience. In that thou wast right, for the secret of man's being is not only to live, but to have something to live for. Without a stable conception of the object of life, man would not consent to go on living and would rather destroy himself than remain on earth, though he had bread in abundance. That's true. But what happened? Instead of taking men's freedom away from them, you made it greater than ever. Did you forget that man prefers peace and even death to freedom of choice in the knowledge of good and evil?" And it's interesting how Dostoevsky sort of plays on this phrase, at least in the translation, knowledge of good and evil. "Nothing is more seductive for man than his freedom of conscience, but nothing a greater cause of suffering. And behold, instead of giving a firm foundation for setting the conscience of man at rest forever, you chose all that is exceptional, vague, enigmatic. You chose what was utterly beyond the strength of men, acting as though thou didst not love them at all, thou who came to give thy life for them. Instead of taking possession of men's freedom, you increased it and burdened the spiritual kingdom of mankind with its sufferings forever. You did desire men's free love, that he should follow thee freely, enticed and taken captive by thee. In place of the rigid ancient law, man must hereafter with free heart decide for himself what is good and evil, having only your image before him as a guide. But you did not know that he would at last reject even thy image and thy truth if he is weighed down with the fearful burden of free choice. They will cry aloud at last that the truth is not in you, for they could not suffering, for they could not have been left in greater confusion and suffering than you have caused, laying upon them so many cares and unanswerable problems. And then he goes on to say that what he, as the Grand Inquisitor, the setting, of course, is in Spain during the Inquisition. What he, as the Grand Inquisitor, who has just returned from burning 100 people at the stake, is doing is offering people an escape from the horrible dilemmas and confusion and uncertainty of having to make their own choices. And if they just come to him, he'll tell them what to do and how to do it and everything. And it turns out that when Christ had first appeared, many people had immediately recognized him for what he was, and had, or at least a certain group of people, not all by any means. And the Inquisitor tells him in the course of this long monologue that on the next day, when he's going to have Christ brought out to be executed like all the rest of the quote heretics, unquote, that those very people the day before who had knelt at his feet would be the first ones at the sign from the Grand Inquisitor to rush in and heap coals on the fire, because they knew, as we put it today, on which side their bread is buttered or where the authority was, etc. Now here's a picture, obviously from a previous century, but not for that so irrelevant, a picture of what role at least Dostoevsky sees the church playing, that the church itself is part of the demonic. I mean, as you read through this, you can't help but get the picture that what he's really done is set up, almost two ideal types, the very godlike Christ on the one hand, who doesn't say a single word throughout the entire passage, and then the extremely demonic representative of the church, this cardinal, this grand inquisitor. And in the light of these other stories where Adam and Eve are, in one sense, rebelling against God, or if you want to put it another way, getting this self-consciousness, or where Prometheus is giving men this creativity, you find again the entrenched authorities, the status quo, as we call it in the 20th century, the establishment, etc., fighting against this, fighting against the outbreak of creativity, fighting against increased awareness of who you are, of what it is to be a human being. Now, it seems to me questions we might ask would be among the following. Does the church, for example, provide models of what it is to be a human being? I happen to be a proverbial PK from the old Augustana Synod, now the LCA, part of the LCA. But it seemed to me, perhaps not so much in my own home, although partly there too, that the pastor, in a sense, was expected, and his wife and family, of course, too, were expected to be models of what it was to be a human being. But really, if you looked at it, they ain't, or they weren't. A pastor was expected not to smoke, and not to drink, and not to swear, and always to smile, and so on. Whereas the people who set him up as a sort of ideal, who engaged in these types of things, and his wife supposedly didn't gossip and so on, and these people were smoking and swearing and drinking and so on, having this surrogate, I suppose, who would mediate for them, sort of carry the burden, a sort of, really almost, and if you want to be literal about it, almost a sort of paschal lamb who would carry all their burdens. But I mean, this was really not a model of humanness. This was a complete perversion, because what they lived out day by day as what it is to be a human being was quite different from this, I would say, phony ideal that they had set up, in which I must admit I myself was expected to participate in. A second question, it seems to me, was what does the church provide context in which this humanness can be nurtured, in which it can grow and develop? I mean, there's been a lot of attack on, you know, the building on the corner and the hour on Sunday morning and the fixed ritual and so on, and it seems to me part of the source of these attacks is precisely the question as to whether or not this is a context for 1969-70 in which creativity, what it is to be a human being, can really be nurtured and developed. I mean, this is partly, I take it, why the underground church has grown up, that people want to relate to each other. Or as Will put it when he was asked earlier this morning about what goes on in a black church, one thing he said very interestingly was, it's a human sort of thing. We do human things like shouting and laughing and singing and clapping each other on the back and hugging and so on. Or again, a third question, which has already been alluded to, can the church provide, in a sense, a renewed vocabulary for our time, related again to our common human experience? I'm not one of those who necessarily pushes for a new vocabulary, totally divorced from anything, but yet it seems to me it should be obvious to everybody, maybe it's not, but it at least should be, that evangelism is not going to get very far pushing things like Christ is of one substance with the Father. I mean, you take that out on the street corners, and it just isn't going to go over too big, I don't think. But even in terms of vocabulary, I mean, realistic vocabulary, you might ask yourself what it means to a child from a broken home to tell him that God is his heavenly Father, or what it means to a child from concrete canyons to say Christ is the Good Shepherd. I mean, this kid hasn't even seen a sheep, much less a shepherd in action. I mean, and so perhaps the metaphors have to shift, like someone has suggested we might want to say Christ is the benevolent gang leader or something, or just the gang leader, pure and simple, however you want to put it. I mean, we have to deal with imagery, but instead of, I mean, the word I used deliberately was renewed vocabulary with the prefix re on there. I mean, some of the vocabulary we have needs to be perhaps toned up or interpreted, if you wish, for our time. I mean, like these stories which we have from very ancient periods, the story of Adam and Eve and the story of Prometheus, it seems to me they speak out of a context of a rather common human experience. As I put it before, perhaps the common human experience that everyone goes through to some degree between the ages of 1 and 3, of becoming aware of oneself as a separate entity who at some point can just turn around and say no to his parents, whatever the consequences might happen to be. This, it seems to me, is very important. Now, the concept that that has been talked about a lot, at least since I got the hold in the last 2 weeks, has been freedom. And here again, this comes into our contemporary scene partly from the context of existentialism. Not that they've got the last word on it, but they have begun to influence the area known as psychotherapy in a way quite different from the way that Freud influenced psychoanalysis or psychotherapy. And I'd like to read just a brief passage from one of these existential psychotherapists by the name of Rollo May, when he talks about freedom and choosing freedom, sort of in the vein of existentialism. And the topic or concept that comes up, as it does in existential philosophy, is death and the concomitant choice of death, namely suicide. And he's saying here that, in effect, what a person needs to do is to think about whether or not he ought to commit suicide. I mean, some of the existentialists, like Camus, proposed this, and people thought it was grotesque. But from the point of view of psychotherapy, where this guy is dealing day in and day out with people who, he has it, the title of the book is Man's Search for Himself, people who have somehow not gotten a self-awareness, or he feels have not gotten a correct one, and they feel out of joint and come to him for help. For these people, he says it's all often helpful to encourage them to think through the consequences of committing or not committing suicide. These ways of choosing not to live, reading now, show how crucial it can be to choose to live. It is doubtful whether anyone really begins to live, that is, to affirm and to choose his own existence, until he has frankly confronted the terrifying fact that he could wipe out his existence, but chooses not to. And I suspect most of us don't get to that level where the day after day of our existence is something that we deliberately choose to do rather than just ending it all here and now. Since one is free to die, one is also free to live. The mass patterns of routine are broken. He no longer exists as an accidental result of his parents having conceived him, of his growing up and living as an infinitesimal item on the treadmill of cause, effect, marrying, begetting new children, growing old and dying. Since he could have chosen to die but chose not to, every act thereafter has to some extent been made possible because of that choice. Every act then has its special element of freedom. And then a page later, the following passage. When one has consciously chosen to live, two other things happen. Now here again, the emphasis for me at least would be on consciously, not just that one goes on living because he never thought about the alternative. First, his responsibility for himself takes on a new meaning. He accepts responsibility for his own life not as something with which he has been saddled, a burden forced on him, but is something that he has chosen himself. For this person himself now exists as a result of a decision he himself has made. To be sure, any thinking person realizes that in theory, freedom and responsibility go together. If one is not free, one is an automaton, and there is obviously no such thing as responsibility. And if one cannot be responsible for himself, he can't be trusted with freedom. But when one has, quote, chosen himself, unquote, this partnership of freedom and responsibility becomes more than a nice idea. He experiences it on his own pulse. In his choosing himself, he becomes aware that he has chosen personal freedom and responsibility for himself in the same breath. The second thing which happens is that discipline from the outside is changed into self-discipline. And here we get back to the concept self. He accepts discipline not because it is commanded, for who can command someone who has been free to take his own life, but because he has chosen with greater freedom what he wants to do with his own life. And discipline is necessary for the sake of the values he wishes to achieve. This self-discipline can be given fancy names. Nietzsche called it loving one's fate, and Spinoza spoke of obedience to the laws of life. But whether bedecked by fancy terms or not, it is, I believe, a lesson everyone progressively learns in his struggle toward maturity. Now these paragraphs come out of, as I said, the concept of psychotherapy. But we might ask, I mean, in the context of the questions I've been raising this morning about freedom and about the struggle involved, about creativity and choice, ethical sensitivity, all of these concepts that I've been bandying about, exactly what role the church, and if we want to perhaps make that more concrete, various institutions of the church, including the family and the Sunday school, all the rest, what role they play, if any, in nurturing and improving what it is to be a human being. And as I said at the outset, God really has not crept in here very much, but since the first day I've arrived, I've heard from Hinderly on down that one has to talk about human before one can begin to talk about Christian, that somehow the two are intertwined, but we really ought to get clear, first of all, about what it is to be a human being. And so it's toward that end that I, if you wish, offer up these few remarks on the altar. Well, I'll just stop there, and we can. If there's maybe there's nothing to discuss since I haven't really put up.
Your concluding remarks suggest that you don't think that the task of the church is to make a person human. I mean, you wouldn't make this identification. Some do, you know. Let's say that the task of the church is to preach the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
Is another way of saying that the task of the church is to affirm the humanness of another person.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I guess I do not see what was contained in my last remarks that would lead to your conclusion.
Well, instead of Hinderly mentioned that we've got to affirm the humanness of a person before we Christianize him or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to speak for him. I'll just say, I mean, you may think I misinterpreted him, but for myself, I mean, that seems plausible too, as to, well, let's put it this way. A lot of, at least systematic theologians, talk about what they call proper humanness, and that this is somehow exemplified in the person of Christ. And there's been big debates going on around here over at least the last couple of weeks as to exactly what the person of Christ shows us. If, for example, it shows us that we shouldn't get married. It seems to be that we ought to be somewhat clear on what it is. Well, here I'm just repeating what it is to be a human being. Sure, the church seems to play a role in this. I suppose in relation to your remarks, I would just ask then what exactly the gospel is that the church is preaching. And that's worth two or three more hours.
It's a big subject.
But I mean, even...
Part of speaking of gospel must be to introduce a person to Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But to affirm another person's humanness, I mean, why would you have to introduce the person to Jesus Christ? It seems that you could, affirm a person's humanness without mentioning Jesus Christ, without introducing to Jesus Christ in any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
contradicts that at all.
That's a problem.
What are you talking about? The word Jesus Christ, the name? The historical character, you don't have to refer to that, so that wouldn't be preaching the gospel.
Well, I realize that we are a little Christ to the person, that's what you're bringing up.
Mm-hmm. Gee. No, I'm saying that I don't think you have to use that the word. I don't think you have to use that language. If you are getting somewhere, place with that person, he's going to ask you, what do you mean to say? I've heard about this guy. Do you mean to say that's what we're talking about? I think if we're getting any place at all with him, he's going to ask us, to whom did we learn, or from whom did we learn? Who's our master? I believe that. I really believe he's going to ask, who is it? And then, if you want to tell him, sure. He'll tell you, though, because he's heard of Jesus. Everybody's heard of him in our civilization. I know.
There was a lady.
One comment. This I'll have to credit to the Bethel Bible series. Maybe some of you don't approve 100% of that, but I have had part of that series, and in that there is an answer to the reason, well, to the relationship between preaching, between creating awareness of our humanness and preaching the gospel. I'll try to explain very briefly. To me, preaching the gospel is simply preaching Christ crucified. That is, Christ as a suffering servant, suffering for the sins of all mankind. Christ taking on himself the burdens, the sins of all mankind. Anything but an oppressor, of course. Completely oppressed. And then, according to what we were taught, and I don't see any reason for disbelieving this, I certainly think it's probably right, that we were taught that Christ was the first and only complete man and perfect man that ever was, or is, or will be. So there's humanity, our humanness. The more Christ-like we are, the more human. And it seems to me it's the same thing, preaching humanness, or making us aware of our humanness, and preaching the gospel would amount to about the same thing, or very nearly the same thing.
I wonder, though, if there hasn't been a tendency for the church to be a part of the structure which dehumanizes and yet tries to preach Christ.
Mm-hmm. All right, there's a distortion there.
Yes, we have dehumanized him by preaching. We haven't preached him so much as we've preached doctrines and that sort of
thing. But even when we've tried to preach Christ, it seems to me we have done it from a point of view in which we have become a part of the system, which makes almost inauthentic anything we say. And we've tried to, we in a sense have done lip service to him.
I really flake out this whole thing. Everything that goes way back to what you're saying about we telling people or proclaiming to people freedom. I don't think we proclaim a thing. I don't think Jesus did. I think he helped people discover, as they were ready, freedom, if that's what they needed at that particular juncture in their life. I think people helped people discover. Jesus helped people discover themselves. You'd say we must have self-awareness, self-discovery. Gee, I see Jesus asking questions, not proclaiming. I see Jesus constantly waiting for the person to be ready. Then when that person is ready, he will discover the Son of God in Jesus of Nazareth. And I think our whole emphasis in proclamation is just really beating our head against the wall. We can't tell people to become aware, to have freedom, or self-actualization, or whatever it might be, what kind of language. I don't think so. That's my feeling.
Well, isn't this one of the differences? I would kind of disagree with you. Isn't this one of the differences between Socrates and Jesus? Because the Gospel of Mark opens where Christ came proclaiming the kingdom of God. There is a definite measure of proclamation in the Gospel, and this is the way, this is kerygma. This is definite proclamation. But at the same time, you can't, of course, make or force a person to self-awareness, but there is revelation in Christianity where God has come to us, and our full humanity has come to us as a proclamation of who we are, God's children. And our humanity is not fully realized until our relationship with God is also restored. And this, to me, is where Christ also has such a power for me, because it brings me back with God. Frankly, outside of Christ, I find God a very devastating kind of thing. And
I don't think there's a difference between Jesus and Socrates. But they were both teachers in the Oriental sense of being a master to whom they did not pound the pulpit. I think there are times, sure, when there are situations, but Jesus, like you say, the Gospel of Mark opens up him coming, proclaiming. I think he just came and people were looking. People were looking certainly for the Messiah. This whole awareness or consciousness that the Messiah has got to be coming. This is about the decade for him to appear. They're all looking. And to them, certainly he proclaimed. Certainly he proclaimed. But that's a different thing. That's a different thing from our going out and telling people, I think. They were looking for the Messiah. You know, the humble, the pious had been looking. This the 70-week thing that all the Hebrews knew about was about. The 70 weeks were about up. The 400 and some years. And the Messiah was to become. It was to be there. If any had been reading their, going to the synagogue and paying attention to what was being said, prophecies of Daniel and so on. They were wide open awaiting it. Sure, he proclaimed it. That's different, I feel.
You read from the Grand Inquisitor. Have you done a fair amount of study of the origins of that any chance? Well, there's one theory, you know, that the Grand Inquisitor was actually, the model of the Grand Inquisitor was a guy by the name of Constantine Pogorelski, who was the over-procurator of the Holy Synod of the Russian Orthodox Church, who proclaimed Christ. There was nobody proclaimed Christ more than the Russian Orthodox Church. But they undermined freedom in every possible way. And this Pogorelski was the arch-conservative against all reforms, had no confidence in parliamentary government, right to vote, believing in the free press, all of that kind of thing. And he constantly pulled the rug out from under all the reforms. And of course, the owners was probably responsible for the Russian Revolution.
No, I didn't know that. Thank you.
He had good Christian reasons for doing all this. Christians just have to really be careful that they don't get their own slant on
Yeah, well, if we're not, I mean, if we were to, well, if we go back through our Western Christianity, or even through the Orthodox you mentioned, obviously we've had a very intellectualized tradition. I mean, you have to believe certain things, you have to repeat certain creeds, you have to say certain things, or else you're out. And it seems, I mean, there always has been a sort of pendulum swing, it seems to be, in the life of the church between a sort of, if you want to use these words, a this worldly emphasis and another worldly emphasis.
Yes, well, that's another deacon of the Russian Orthodox. Very suspicious of any knowledge, but they thought intellectual knowledge was a tool of God, and it was better to keep people ignorant than they wouldn't be free to read bad books.
Mm-hmm. But then it would seem that, I mean, if we agree with this gentleman over here about proclamation, then maybe the emphasis should shift over to action or something of that sort. I mean, if the life of Christ is a life of action, he went around healing and this type of thing, and maybe that's where it's at.
Can we get back to your original thing that you start out with? You start out with this innocent or this vision of bliss, you know, the Garden of Eden thing, and then you even cited this childhood thing, one or two. Well, it's earlier than that, I think, as Freudians would say, the polymorphous perverse, the child's feeling of utter contentment and the state of satiation when he's had a mouthful from the breast of the mother and clean diaper and all that sort of a thing. That state of bliss, that vision of peace, I see throughout the Old Testament. I see this as even part of this thing I was saying, that the Jewish people were looking in for the Messiah to bring about this kingdom of God, this beatific vision that Isaiah talked about, all the prophets. And I think that, gee, that's so psychologically as well as spiritually, part of my being, at least, my wish, my hope, my desire, and my purpose seeking to bring this about. I like that, and I thought you got away from that point after a while and turned it into rather, as you say, the existential dilemma of to be or not to be. I thought you got away from that original feeling for unity, harmony, joy, bliss.
But it seems to me that those categories do not characterize the world in which we live, from the breakfast table to the conference table. I mean, it may be a sort of Freudian wish to get back into the womb, or maybe some sort of religious wish to achieve some sort of eschaton, so that it's all, you know, the lamb will lie down with the lion and so on. But in the meantime, we're living where we're at, and it seems to me that to get on where we're at, we need this, what I was calling here, I guess, a sort of heightened self-awareness. I mean, that most people are very reluctant, as Socrates found out and as people have been finding out ever since, people are very reluctant to confront themselves, to really figure out who and what they are and what they're doing, why they're doing it, and so on. That's the early setting of lunch, if anybody wants to go there.
First setting. Yeah.